Hi, I'm here to extol the virtues of Pesca Plus. Now, full disclosure, I am Pesca and have been accused of being a little plus. But if you subscribe, and you do so by going to subscribe.mikepesca.com, you get all sorts of bonus features. We do extended interviews. We have a book club every other month. We had an amazing live event. I don't know if we'll ever replicate this, but it was a soiree plus a discussion with members of the Fifth Column. And it's free for everyone who is a Pesca Plus member. Now is the best time to get your membership approved. I have to tell you, the approval process, you're going to skate through. I know this because, as I said before, I am the titular Pesca of Pesca Plus. And of course, like all of our subscription services, all the podcasts will be ad-free, but with Pesca Plus, oh so much more. Subscribe.mikepesca.com. It's Thursday, March 13th, 2025. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Rodrigo Duarte has taken a flight to The Hague, not for the legendarily mind-expanding coffee shops. The former president of the Philippines, whose drug crackdown killed an estimated 30,000, is there for crimes against humanity. Duarte was a thug and a braggart, and every press conference he held could serve as evidence for the prosecutor. But at the same time, this is an inherently political prosecution, and perhaps, likely, a righteous one. So the Interpol warrant was signed by Ferdinand Marcos Jr. Marcos Jr. gained the presidency by running with Duarte's daughter on a unity ticket. Now, Marcos Jr.'s party is pursuing her in impeachment hearings as her father is on trial internationally, the International Criminal Court. Marcos's own father, you remember him, he escaped prosecution. He lived out his days in Hawaii after stealing an estimated $5 to $10 billion in the shoes. Oh, the shoes. The elder Marcos killed only 3,000 or so extrajudicially. Duarte's body count could be 10 times that. Maybe it's only 4 times that. But complicatedly, he was popular. Duarte got elected saying he would kill drug dealers, and then he did kill drug dealers, and the populace of the Philippines liked it a lot. He left office with sky-high approval ratings. It doesn't make it right. My point is that much of the Philippines bears culpability for the death toll, as do the international drug syndicates, which threatened to turn the Philippines into a narco state, as do drug users throughout the world and in the United States. ICC trials take forever. The last one, which ended in conviction, took 6 years. The one before that, Herman Katengo of the Congo, took 7.5 years. Rodrigo Duarte is 79 years old. On the show today, it's part two of my spiel, 9 bullets, 1 knife, many wrong questions. But first, it's a cold night. You're walking down a dark street. You left behind the glow of neon and streetlights long ago. You see someone lurking, I'd say in the shadows, but there needs to be some light cast to create a shadow. This figure strides behind you, matching you pace for pace, and then his footsteps increase. You feel him upon you. He's reaching out. You know you're in danger. Every ounce of your being urges you to scream. But what? Help comes to mind. But then you remember hearing, oh, maybe I should yell fire instead of help. Well, I can't keep you out of that dark part of town on that cold night, but I can give you the right answer for what you should yell as determined by science. Sadie Dingfelder is here armed with studies. She's fired up, ready to help. She's here to play Is That Bullshit? Sadie Dingfelder up next. In First Amendment law, the old saying is you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. And the but actually crowd, who I appreciate, will quickly come in and say, actually, you can. That's a little beside the point, because we're not talking about the yelling of fire when there is a fire or when you're in a theater. There is another anecdotal piece of advice out there that I have heard that instead, if a woman, let's say, is being attacked, instead of saying, stop, attacker, I'm being attacked, what the woman should do is yell fire. Okay, that's interesting. I could see why it would hit society as that's so sad or that's effective and let's be armed and forewarned. But the question is it true or is it bullshit? And because we're playing Is It Bullshit, I welcome now Sadie Dingfelder. She is the author of Do I Know You? A Face-Blind Reporter's Journey into the Science of Sight, Memory, Imagination, and the Yelling of Fire when you should be yelling, I'm attacked. Sadie, welcome back to The Gist.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the actual piece of advice in a sentence? And have you ever gotten that advice? Were you advised to yell fire?
Absolutely. It was in my high school psychology textbook.
Uh-huh.
But it was right next to the story of Kitty Genovese.
Okay.
So already we're having some apocryphal stories.
So the story of Kitty Genovese is this is a woman who was attacked and she was stabbed to death outside of her apartment in Kew Gardens. And the anecdote is that although all the neighbors heard her cries for help, no one did anything, and it became this huge symbol, but it didn't exactly happen. And there was a neighbor who helped, and that neighbor was gay, and maybe that's why they didn't talk about the neighbor. And so it was Kitty Genovese. Really interesting story, interesting documentary, but not true, right?
Not at all true. It has been so thorough. I feel like it's got to be the most debunked story because there was at least 5 books about it.
Yes.
And 2 documentaries.
Yeah, Jim Solomon did a great documentary about it. Okay, was that being presented in your high school textbook as true?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, okay. So next to true is building on this idea. Well, we all know Kitty Genovese was attacked and no one said anything. So what you should do or what Kitty should have done is yell fire, they were saying.
Yeah, yeah.
And did they back that up? I'm asking you to remember back to high school psychology. Did they back that up with a study or just an idea, just a supposition?
It was just a supposition.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I went and looked to try to find where else it was found. I mean, I found it in lots of psychology textbooks, older, usually like pretty old though. And let's see. But the most recent example was 2023 in an English expression dictionary for Chinese speakers.
Oh, no.
The example sentence is actually showing you how to use the word cry out. And confronted. But it says, when confronted with a dangerous situation, cry out for assistance. Yelling fire, fire, instead of help will generally bring faster assistance.
Okay. So we're miseducating Chinese speakers, but probably it also plays into what the Communist Party would like them to believe about the West. Like everyone's getting attacked. And, yeah. But there are also, from what I understand, there are training seminars or first defense or self-defense classes.
Yeah.
Like even a half hour first defense seminar might say, and here's one practical piece of advice, yell fire instead of help.
Right.
And that gets said all the time still to this day.
Yes. And with the help of a Reddit sleuth named Quixotischist, I have his real name too, but I forgot it. Anyway, he found a 1912 book in translation from it's a French guide to self-defense for the mean streets of pre-World War I Paris.
Oh, really?
And I don't know if that's where it came from, but that's the earliest example anyone's found of this exact advice.
Yelling fire instead of help.
Yes.
That's interesting because I put it, I thought of the idea as quintessentially American and also trying to make the point that our fellow Americans are indifferent and especially indifferent to the plight of women. I mean, part of this idea is that no one wants to help a woman or people are afraid to help, to be an intervener, but out of self-interest, they might pay attention to a fire. So I guess some ideas like that exist throughout cultures, certainly pre-World War I Paris.
Well, if you think about pre-World War I Paris, that is a place and a time when everyone had their windows open for ventilation because we didn't have air conditioning and that kind of thing. And also fires were regularly burning down entire city blocks.
Yeah, things were made of wood. Fire was much more dangerous then. That's interesting. Now, being attacked is more dangerous than a fire. We've kind of inverted that, I think.
I would, yeah. But the idea is really specific to that moment in history where it's like, if you're being attacked on, like, let's say an empty street, like Kitty Genovese, and you yell, you want your neighbors to hear. Their windows are open. They might hear you yelling, help mugger rapist. And the idea is in the self-interested neighbors don't want to run out and get involved with a mugger or whatever. But if you yell fire, they're all going to immediately leave their houses because they do not want to burn down in their houses.
Oh, I see. So it gets people out of a house. Because I was also thinking, fire, you might want to go in the other direction. I don't know if you'd want to be drawn to an attack or an attacker. It seems, but, you know, fires are also pretty scary.
Well, you know, according to this guy, and he was the head, George Du Bois. I'm sure I'm saying that wrong.
Jorge Du Bois.
He was the head of security at the Paris Opera, and he was a French boxer.
Yeah.
Most famous for losing an MMA match against a diminutive jiu-jitsu mat's
jiu-jitsu
in just 6 seconds. He lost it in 6 seconds.
Wait, when was this?
This was the early 1900s.
But there was no MMA then.
I know, but it was MMA. I mean, it was a boxer against a...
So this guy was in charge of keeping the Phantom of the Opera at bay. That's what Paris Opera House security did back then.
Yeah, so clearly he knew what he was talking about.
Guys in a mask, you watch him yell fire or
in
fog.
In the same book that is fantastic, it has all these great illustrations. that and it's been translated to English, and I bought one, but I haven't gotten it yet. He also suggests how to deal with fires in theaters.
Yes, and?
So he says you do not just run for the exit. That's how you get crushed.
Yeah.
Just chill out and then go to the orchestra pit where there is an exit to the outdoors. Now it's usually blocked, but if you throw a shoulder against it or if you yell through it, the police will the firemen will help you.
This seems maybe good for 1906 Paris. I would think clearly marked exits in current American theaters are a better way to exit than searching through the orchestra pit. By the way, they've taken out the orchestra pit in most theaters. They do it remotely, so I don't know how practical this is. Less practical than yelling fire instead of I'm helping being attacked. Oh, so this is so far, I didn't realize how far back this went. I didn't realize how cross-cultural this idea was. I thought it was more an indictment of the United States. But tell me, has anyone actually put it to the test? You've identified it as an old wives' tale, but some old wives' tales work.
Right. I am so excited that some people did put it to the test in 1980.
This is a fun experiment to do.
It was very fun, and I don't think you could do it today.
Well, you have to tell the police beforehand what you're doing. We're psychology students.
So they were in a psychology building, and they told 87 students, but 7 of them were dropped from the final analysis. I'm telling you this because you'd like to do math in your head. They had these students go to, like, one room, and they did a sham eye-hand coordination test. And then they sent them to a second room to get the extra credit for taking the study, like some sort of sign-off card.
Yeah.
And the second room was downstairs one floor. And while they're waiting at the second room, they see someone drag a lady, like they see a large man drag a woman across the hallway, a smallish woman, into a room, lock the door, and then they played a tape and they checked to make sure the tape sounded real.
Yeah.
They used special audio equipment. And the tape was the same for all the conditions except for they would just replace the phrase that the woman yells, either help, she would either say help rape, call the police, or she would blow a whistle, or she would say fire, or there was a condition with she didn't ask for any particular help.
Did the attacker wear a mask and play the pipe organ at any point?
No.
Getting back to that guy?
No.
No, no. He's a misunderstood anti-hero, by the way, the Phantom.
He is.
Yes.
Yeah. I love that. I love that show. They found that there. Okay, so there. I didn't tell you there was also another complication where some of the people didn't see the dragging across the hall. They only heard the whole thing.
All right.
And that was the only significant result in the study. The students that saw someone get dragged across the hall.
I'll predict no matter what she said, they intervened.
Unfortunately, not all of them intervened even in that case, but they were much more likely to.
Was there a difference in intervention based on fire or help in that?
The type of intervention?
Yeah.
No, not statistically.
No, was there a difference in if they intervened based on the word?
No. Okay. No. Not statistically.
Yeah.
They said there was a trend. And then, because that's obviously the question we want them to answer, they told us some pilot data.
Yeah.
And in their pilot study, they did get significant results where more people, so the most people helped when they said help rape,
yeah,
which was 50% of the participants intervened for that one. 36% when they heard the whistle and 22% when they heard the fire message.
When, okay, and that was if they saw the woman being dragged or if not?
That, so this was a pilot study.
Yeah.
I think it occurred in a restroom or something.
Uh-huh.
They really didn't describe it. But it, I got the sense that this one was more visual.
Yeah. So this is not a, I mean, I guess they tried their best or it's the only one out there. This ain't a great study.
It's not a great study. But there's a lot of research on the bystander effect because of our friend Kitty Genovese.
Yes.
And can I tell you my favorite one?
Yes.
My favorite study was in 1973, and it was researchers at Princeton. They recruited a bunch of seminary students, and they had them take a survey about their sort of reasons for joining the seminary.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, okay, now you're going to go to place B and give a sermon on the parable of the Good Samaritan. And so these seminary students are walking from point A to point B, where they find someone in need of help, like laying literally across their path. They have to step over this guy.
Exactly like the Good Samaritan. Yes.
And so the results were only 40% stopped to help that guy.
Even while primed with the assignment of give me a survey of the Good Samaritan.
Like, presumably they're rehearsing this in their minds.
Yes.
And 63%. Okay. Oh, yeah. So there were some conditions. One of them was they're like, oh, you've got plenty of time. You're running early. Another one was they're like, you're on time or whatever. And then the other was like, you're running late. Only 10% helped in the you're running late condition.
Yeah, you got to tell people about the Good Samaritan. I do think that there's probably a way to see. I mean, fire departments know if yelling fire actually helps people intervene. And police departments know or have some sort of sense if I'm being attacked actually helps intervention. Is this advice, even though there's a really bad study somewhat disputing it, is this advice still currently very popular to give out?
It is still popular. And I think that the research, the body of research would suggest it's very bad advice.
Yeah.
Because the main thing that helps causes people to intervene or not is the ambiguity of the situation. So if you're being, so if people are not sure that you need help or they're not sure what kind of help you need, then they are really unlikely to act.
So wait, if you say, if they're not sure, okay, if they're not sure, they're unlikely to act. So if they see something where they have to do some mental processes, it gets in the way of them intervening. But if you give them a direct piece of, not advice, but direction, help, they will help.
Well, it would be even better to be like, hey, guy in the green shirt, call the police.
Yes.
But also,
here, hand me your phone. I'll dial the 9 and the 1. Exactly.
Right. But if you don't, you could also just clarify the situation, because you could say like, help, I don't know this man.
Mm-hmm.
This man is assaulting me. He grabbed my purse. Chase him. Something like that.
And what if you just yelled fire?
But they're going to be, people will be confused. And I think that's going to reduce the likelihood people are going to help you.
Right. Because if you're being attacked and you yell, I'm being attacked, that's unambiguous. Oh, that's what's going on. If you yell fire when you're being attacked, people will look, see no fire and say, maybe this person's a little weird.
Yeah.
I wonder, I've never, I think I've heard people say attack. I don't know if I've ever heard someone yelling fire. I definitely have never come across this situation or even heard of anyone who came across the situation or even heard from someone who said, I remembered the advice and I yelled fire and it worked.
Right.
Have you ever just anecdotally heard someone ever say that? I remember the advice, I yelled fire and it worked.
No, but honestly, I can't think of anyone I know who's been attacked on the street, including me. And I wander around sketchy neighborhoods by myself in the dark all the time.
You also carry dry kindling with you. So the fire is more likely as well.
George Du Bois has a suggestion that is very on in line with that.
The Parisian theater
master
detective.
At arms. Yeah. He said that if you're a lady walking around by yourself and you can't stand to have a knife or a pistol on you, have handfuls of ash mixed with pepper and just throw it in the faces of your attacker. And you're all
set. Guy, I mean, maybe things were a lot, certainly things were a lot more dangerous in Paris pre-World War I, but man, his advice is just, it just seems to be much, much more onerous than, I don't know, heading for the exits or having, like, you're going to walk around with ash, but not a knife. Okay. All right. The pistol, I understand, but...
If you do walk around with a knife, he suggests wrapping it in a tea towel so that you're not accosted by police. And hold it, like, kind of out.
I love this guy. This guy. There is a John Mulaney character almost entirely based on this guy who has, you know, advice on not to get kidnapped. A square-jawed John Mulaney character. Okay, so this is what we're here for. We're here to hear about what was going on in the MMA theater scene in pre-World War I Paris. But we're really here to get a ruling. So I shall ask you, if you are attacked, yelling fire instead of help will help your chances of someone intervening. Is that bullshit?
Yes, I feel that that's bullshit.
All right. Sadie Dingfelder is the author of Do I Know You? A Faceblind Reporter's Journey into the Science of Sight, Memory, Imagination, and Warding Off Attackers with Ash. Sadie, Sadie, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
And now the spiel. 9 bullets, 4 shot, all the wrong questions, part 2. On a September Sunday in Brooklyn, a police interaction with a knife-wielding man escalated into pure chaos. 4 people shot, including Darrell Mickles, who refused 38 commands to drop his weapon. 2 innocent bystanders caught in the crossfire, 1 seriously injured, and even one of the officers himself catching a bullet. Body camera footage shows Mickles advancing on police even after tasers failed to stop him, repeatedly telling officers to shoot me. The questions hanging in the air, what should police have done when confronted with this armed, threatening man in a crowded subway? According to one witness quoted by the New York Times, the answer is nothing. Police should have walked away. Yesterday, we examined how this subway shooting unfolded. Today, we'll scrutinize how the Times and other media outlets frame these events in ways that seem stuck in a pre-pandemic mindset, one that disregards the real-life lessons of depolicing and pullbacks in the name of radically reimagining public safety. In cities that pulled back most aggressively on policing, the consequences have been stark. Murders in Minneapolis more than doubled from the 2010s to 2022. In Portland, homicides increased from a total of 20 in the year 2016 to 101 in 2022 after officials cut millions from the police budget after George Floyd was killed in 2020. Major newspapers serve as thought leaders and crucial civic voices in shaping policing debates. While the New York Times occasionally produces excellent work examining the complex trade-offs inherent in policing decisions, too often it presents the most aggrieved claims of protesters and critics as reasonable or even factual. Their coverage of the Mickles shooting began misleadingly, with a headline 2 days after the incident, quote, "Critics question NYPD shootings after fare evasion stop in subway." 6 months later came this headline, "One hop turnstile, 9 police bullets, 4 people shot. Does it add up?" Headlines telegraph what outlets believe are the most important elements of a story. The omission of any reference to Mickles' knife, while emphasizing fare evasion, reveals what the Times believes this incident is fundamentally about. They're wrong. It's not just the Times. In New York Magazine and on public radio station WNYC, protesters' voices received prominent placement, while police explanations were treated not merely as versions to be vetted, which would be proper, but as inherently suspect. Knife-wielding attackers aren't described as lunging at cops. They're described as lunging, in scare quotes. Details that might justify police actions are routinely downplayed. Consider another story that received prominent coverage, emphasizing the sad over the salient, the police shooting of Kowalski Trawick. Media accounts repeatedly emphasized that the shooting occurred in Trawick's own apartment or in his own kitchen. Only deeper in these stories would readers discover that Trawick was actively charging at officers with a knife when shot. In his own apartment, yes, but wielding a deadly weapon nonetheless. Which brings us back to the non-fatal shooting of Darrell Mickles, two bystanders, and Officer Edmund Mays in that Brooklyn subway. Mickles was armed, refused to drop his knife despite dozens of commands, had been tased to no effect, and rushed at Officer Mays. What should the police have done? Nothing, apparently. That is the astonishing suggestion of David LaFauci, a witness quoted by the Times, who wondered whether, quote, Mr. Mickles would have just gone on his way had he not been approached by the police. This question, never answered, conveniently ignores the knife, the threats, and the danger posed to everyone in the station. Perhaps LaFauci's perspective becomes clearer when we learn that he acknowledges, quote, I'm not the most pro-police guy. He was arrested at a George Floyd protest in 2020, sued the city, and received a $115,000 settlement. Now he's suing again for emotional distress over the Mickles incident, asking taxpayers to compensate him because an armed man wouldn't comply with police orders. If bystanders receive payouts every time police use force to protect the public, we will soon lack resources for policing altogether, which police abolitionists and their media allies would consider an acceptable outcome. Here lies my fundamental problem with the New York Times approach in this story and many others. It fails to treat a serious civic question seriously. The let's not enforce this law argument is frozen in 2019, a period when fantasies of massive police pullback seemed plausible because crime rates were low. This mindset views policing not as a necessary tool for public safety, but as fundamentally a force of oppression, never a force for order. The Times' context-free citing of racial statistics exemplifies this outdated approach. The article notes that only 5% of those arrested and 16% of those ticketed for fare evasion in New York are white. But these percentages only become meaningful when compared to the actual demographics of fare evaders, a figure we do not have. The city is 30.9% non-Hispanic white, but only 24% of white New Yorkers rely on the subway for commuting, compared to 44% of black New Yorkers. As I said, there is no denominator for that 16% figure. The argument that law enforcement must be racially biased solely because of arrest rates no longer deserves serious consideration outside explicitly ideological publications. Likewise, the reflexive rejection of fare enforcement serves as a proxy for rejecting policing altogether. This is a position that a lot of people have. It's called police abolition. Whatever its merits as an academic exercise, this ideology does not deserve serious consideration in solution-oriented civic discourse. Now, if New York made subways free, as Kansas City and Albuquerque have done with their buses, we could have a different conversation. But as long as transit requires payment, we need enforcement mechanisms, not because of some controversial policing theory, but because that is how payment for services function in an organized society. Fare enforcement should, of course, be proportional, professional, and humane, absolutely, but abandoning it entirely ignores $800 million in lost revenue, the weapons seized during the stops, and most importantly, the millions of riders who dutifully pay their fares and deserve safe passage. None of this excuses the injuries to innocent bystanders. Gregory Delpeschi and Carrie Ann Jahalal deserve compensation and our collective sympathy for the wounds suffered during the shooting. They were simply commuting and should not have been caught in the crossfire. Could perfect policing tactics have prevented this shooting? Maybe. But the definition of perfect policing isn't policing up to the point where officers get injured or bystanders are hurt. There are legitimate questions to be asked about this incident, but those questions are ones of tactical positioning, marksmanship, and bystander safety. The Times, however, is not engaging in such a useful inquiry. Instead, the paper and much of today's media appears not to have absorbed the lessons from our post-George Floyd experiment with diminished police departments. They continue to amplify old complaints about over-policing while ignoring the background conditions of crime, public sentiment, and, very importantly, the documentary evidence of what actually happened. When a man brandishes a weapon, refuses dozens of commands to drop the weapon, tells officers to shoot him, advances despite tasers, and declares his intention to make police kill him, the story cannot honestly be reduced to one hop turnstile, nine police bullets, four people shot, does it add up? That equation will never add up because it deliberately omits the most important variable. And that's it for today's show. The Gist is produced in two parts by Corey Wara, Michelle Pesca, CBSO. Leo Baum is our intern. Tell us what you think about this big two-parter. Umpru, Jeepru, Dupru, and thanks for listening.